Game on, weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
Thanks to Andrew Dupuyer, it is the 10th of April and this is Game On. Coming up today, Liverpool and Arsenal played out a crazy encounter at Anfield yesterday. We'll try and make sense of it all. And after a weekend of surprises in the Gaelic Football Championship, we'll reflect on the action with Peter Canavan and Neil Ewing. Plus, Jane Mangan joins us fresh from the Grand National. If you want to get in touch, please text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
Now, welcome along. Alan Cawley is with me in studio. Alan, good weekend of sport?
Great weekend of sport, Marie, yeah. There's been that much on, I don't know where to start, really, to be honest with you. So, you might kind of kick things off for us, will you? I don't know where to start.
I was thinking about highlights and trying to figure out what was the thing that really stands out for me as the takeaway. And I guess, look, when it comes to sport, you can't help at times just to be parochial, to keep it local. And watching Clare yesterday get a big win in the Munster Championship for me was huge. They beat Cork by just a point. But it was the manner in which they closed out the game, Alan. They hadn't done that well in Division 2. They'd had a few tight games where they hadn't been able to get over the line and there was a few question marks about them and whether or not they'd be able to get the job done on the big day, and they absolutely were. And for Cullum Collins, who's been with the team now for a decade, I think he's the longest serving GAA manager at the moment, I was just thrilled for him, for his son Podge Collins as well, just for all the players. Not that it was only Cork, but it's always hard to beat a team, you know, the big teams, traditionally the big teams in Munster anyway. So for them to get that big win, I was absolutely delighted.
Yeah, and as you say, 10 years, Colin, that's a fair stint.
And that's a commitment.
That is a proper commitment, yeah. When you think of the amount of stories we hear around lads who obviously are trying to commit time, not only as players but as management as well, to county and inter-county football, for managers to go 10 years, Marie, when everybody talks about it being 24-7, such an effort it is, obviously, to just keep things going on and off the pitch. That's some stint, and he gets his rewards. And there, as you were just speaking, if you're going to keep it local and parochial, I'm trying to go back, as you were speaking there, I'm trying to go back to Good Friday, and obviously there was all the stuff, the games on Good Friday, we had the Premier League fixtures, mm-hmm. but the League of Ireland, and we speak about that a lot. My own Sligo Rovers, who I follow, had a brilliant win up in Dundalk. I'm heading to the game tonight against Shelburne after this, Marie. I'm looking forward to it. They're sitting third in the league. But I watched Shamrock Rovers against Bowes, and I know you have a soft spot for Shamrock Rovers. And I have to say, it was the best performance I've seen from them in a long, long time. Of course, we're friendly with Jack. It looked like he was back to his best. Graham Burke was phenomenal.
He was brilliant. Yeah,
he was absolutely brilliant, Burke. And it sets it up lovely because we've a round of fixtures tonight as well, which I'm sure we'll discuss later on. Saturday, I was watching the Old Firm game, brilliant as well, watching Man United. We had the golf, then you had all the Gaelic yesterday. I was watching a bit of the racing today. So yeah, Marie,
there was so much on, wasn't
it? Too much, nearly.
I wanted to get into it quickly, if you don't mind, Al. We didn't mention the Ireland women against the USA and their performance. They suffered a 2-0 defeat, but they look like they've improved. And we talk about the importance of, you know, not stagnating, about always moving forward, and Vera Powell now seems to have done that with her team. There's been a lot of criticism of them because of their low block that they play, but you know, they needed to do that to qualify for the World Cup. They've got there now, and I felt that the addition of Sinead Farrelly added a lot to the to the midfield, that they looked a little bit more creative. They were missing a type of player like that. She's 33, she didn't have the legs for the 90 minutes. She's been away from the game for almost 8 years. But I just felt, you know, you throw in Kyra Caruso as well, and her being that target woman, it felt like they have developed a bit, and we maybe hadn't seen that from them. But heading into a World Cup and seeing that they've a few more layers and a few more elements to their game is really positive.
Yeah, and I think what's justified as well is Vera's decision to go and play against the USA, Marie, as well, because you would have maybe over the years, and obviously when we weren't as good as what we are now, you would have been kind of fearful for that kind of fixture. When you look at the performance that they put in as well, and obviously we've spoken a lot about the development over the last 2-3 years under Vera, I think she was brave in that call, and it was justified as well when you think of the performance that they put in. The thing that is sticking out for me at the moment, you know, there's a World Cup on the horizon, because it's like all the girls are raising their game, because they know as well there's places up for grabs, Marie. Nobody is set in stone in terms of the squad. Obviously you'll have the mainstays of players that have taken them to this, as far as this, but as you say, Kyra Caruso, I thought, played really well the other night. You have some of the new girls coming into the squad, and it just looks like there's that edge about them that they know they have to perform every opportunity that they get, because they want to be on that plane.
the only, I look, I guess, the negative for me was that you're looking at the USA and, you know, it's quite evident what we don't have. And they have that pace and the athleticism and they have it everywhere. And that's difficult. Mm. But at the same time, we were able to counter that. But when we're heading to the World Cup and you're going to be playing against a Canada who are quite similar, and Australia as well, quite similar, we probably do need to temper the expectations a little bit. Maybe we might get one big result, which they're capable of, but getting out of that group is going to be hard.
Yeah, absolutely. But like you're speaking about USA, who are one of the very best and have developed for how many number of years now, Marie? So they're almost kind of at the end of their development. Mm-hmm. When you see how good they are in terms of winning World Cups and all sorts, we're very much in the infancy. First time to ever qualify for a major tournament. You speak there about Vera's approach and the low block. That's okay, and they're well disciplined and organised in that approach. The next step now in their development, as you say, to bring it on, where you have to obviously go into games where you're trying to create chances, win matches, and score goals as well. So I think, to be fair to Vera, I think the approach has been right. The prep games of the playing against the likes of USA, obviously because of who we're going to face in the World Cup as well and how difficult it's going to be, I think she's getting it all right so far, Marie. But it is going to be, and I don't think she's under any illusions as well in terms of what's facing us in the World Cup. And I don't think anyone should have this should get too carried away in terms of the expectation, because it is our very first one. Obviously everybody's going to get behind it, there's going to be huge enthusiasm and excitement, and rightly so. But I think in terms of what we're expecting of the girls, I don't think we should be expecting too much. That's not to say we're going over there thinking we have no chance, they have every chance of getting out of the group, but you do need that one big result and hopefully they're capable of it.
Okay, sure, we'll be talking about that a lot over the next few months. We're going to turn our attention to Gaelic football now, and Peter Canavan and Neil Ewing join us on the line. Peter, I keep throwing random questions at you, and I'm not going to stop doing that now. We're talking about Vera Powell and the Republic of Ireland women's team, and the fact that they've qualified for a World Cup, but she's still bringing in new players. And I guess, look, we don't know how loyal she's going to be as a manager and someone that's been in that sphere. Do you think she should be loyal to the players that have got her to the World Cup, or is she right to bring in the new women?
Yeah, hi Marie. Yeah, you really, it's very hard to make a call when you're not there and you don't know the standard of player that she has got. It's a very brave call to be making, to disregard people, you know, who's got her there. But there's nobody knows that better than the management and the people that's there and seeing them. But certainly if they're making the effort, and she's thrusted them up to this point. But what it does do, it freshens things up, and maybe it's a vote of confidence in the new players that she's bringing in. And if they can add value to it, then it doesn't matter what age they are. You mm-hmm. see Dublin bringing in Stephen Clarkson to their panel. You know, there's a reason for doing that. They believe that he's going to assist them and add value. So it's a big judgment call, mm-hmm. but if you know, it's a sign of faith. And if they do well, then she'll be proven right. And likewise, if they don't deliver and they play below standards, then you know, you live and die by the decisions you make.
Yeah, look, it's going to be a really interesting time. And as you said, it's when they get there and see what happens. Then that's when she'll know whether she made the right calls or not. We can move on to the Gaelic football now, Peter. And it was a brilliant weekend, and I think maybe heading into it, because a lot of the narrative, a lot of the opinion pieces written about the start of the championship were negative about the provincial championships, and I don't know how much anticipation there was, because there was that kind of that narrative around that they were warm-up competitions. But this weekend it certainly didn't feel like that, and there were so many great results and important results and brilliant games. I don't know where to start, but I guess we probably should start with Saturday and New York, Peter, and beating Leitrim and getting that first win in the Connacht Championship and what it means to everybody.
Absolutely. The scenes in Gaelic Park were something else, Marie, and it was fantastic to see. The part that struck me, you know, when I was watching it, was the amount of youngsters that was in on the pitch. Normally you associate, you know, with the New York teams, men and women who have been there for a right few years and are back, but the amount of youngsters, and that's down to the work that's going on there and by so many clubs with their underage players, and their problem has been getting them up to, you know, 16-17 hasn't been a problem. There's been a great interest, but then they haven't been able to bring them through. But to, you know, there's Shane Carthy, a number of the Brosnan lads, to see the homegrown talent coming through, that's got to be the way for New York. they're probably, you know, for years they've been trying to get a new ground there. There's talk that more money was going to be spent by Croke Park and indeed by New York and keeping money within the city and try and develop the game further. This will certainly bolster those plans. And look, it's, you feel for Andy Moore and the Leitrim lads, but as I said yesterday, it was inevitable that it was going to happen at some stage. New York have a lot of good players there, and things came together for them on Saturday night, and it sets up a very interesting clash now with Sligo.
It absolutely does, and that brings us nicely along to Neil Ewing. Neil, look, I guess before we move on to the clash with Sligo, I think New York having achieved that now, and it makes it, you know, it's almost a bit like the Vera Powell situation. You know, they've qualified for a World Cup and there's players coming out from everywhere. It makes playing for New York now very attractive, doesn't it, if you're over there?
Yeah, definitely. You know, a huge win. And as Peter said there, you have to be particularly delighted for the homegrown players on the New York team. You know, great achievement by the people involved with New York to bring those guys through to senior level. You know, I know personally, I would have said that I actually don't think New York should be in the Connacht Championship. And, you know, I think that can be perceived as a slight on New York, but it's in no way meant as that. I just don't think it's fair for New York that they're guaranteed only one game in Gaelic Park every year. You know, I'd love to see us getting more of our intercounty teams over there to play. Difficult to do, I know, but, you know, if we could even get our league champions over there, you know, guarantee New York a game, maybe even bring in teams from Boston, Philadelphia, Chicago, where the GAA scene is very strong over there as well. You know, make it a real festival of football, you know, over two or three weekends even. Something like that would be brilliant. You know, while Saturday was excellent for New York and, you know, it'll probably sustain a lot of the work that's gone on there, you know, one win in 24 years isn't enough to keep growing the game. You know, I think it's been coming. It's not a surprise that they won on Saturday, and that's no slight on Leitrim. You know, I feel, you know, very sorry for the Leitrim lads that went over. They'll be, you know, wrongfully disrespected for losing a game, but they lost a game to a team with some super, super mm-hmm. players that would get into Division 1 teams back here at home. But yeah, it sets it up nicely for New York now to come to Sligo and a shot at a Connacht final in 2 weeks' time. And, you know, again, that touches maybe on one of the things that I see as a struggle for New York in the Connacht Championship is they come home in 2 weeks. They beat Sligo, they have to come back again in 2 weeks' time. And for amateur players, you know, in New York to be coming home to Ireland for 3 or 4 days at a time every 2 weeks is difficult as well. But yeah, hugely mouth-watering encounter in Sligo in 2 weeks' time.
And just a word then on Sligo and London at the weekend as well. Big win for them. Kind of just went and got it done, really. It was the opposite of what happened in New York. There was no drama. It was a very straightforward win over London.
Yeah, it was straightforward. And, you know, the most comforting thing, I suppose, for me, or the most encouraging thing was, you know, they were able to put London probably even to arm's length a little bit in the first half. And I think if you go away on some of those trips and you give the underdog a chance, you know, the crowd, the momentum can really get behind them. It's very hard to sway it back in your favour then. So, very comfortable in the end. But, you know, probably the first half is where Sligo showed a little bit of experience, a little bit of know-how and the quality shone through. So, yeah, great to get to back up last week's league win. Get that tricky encounter in New York out of the way and look forward to a home game now in 2 weeks' time.
Peter, I think we should stick with the surprise results of the weekend and have a look at Clare and Cork. It was only a 1-point win, but it was a big win for Colm Collins, it felt like, and his team.
Yeah, only seen the highlights last night, but, you know, Sean Kavanagh described it as a 1-point hammering, and that was based on the amount of possession that Clare actually had, the amount of scoring opportunities that they had, and only they were wasteful in front of goal. They would have won by more. The bookies had Cork fairly warm favourites. I was surprised at that because I certainly give Clare every chance. I fancied them at the start of the year to get to the Munster final, and they have proven that. They have, you know, Neil refers to New York having players that are fourth division players. You only had to watch, you know, Jamie Malone, mm-hmm. Keelan Saxon last night. One of the scores, and in particular the solo dummy and kicking it over the bar, they have got quality, and Colm Collins have got one of the longest serving intercounty manager at the minute, who year after year continues to get the best out of his players. And in terms of, apart from the individual side of things, you know, his tactical appreciation of the game, he obviously identified Sean Powder and Matty Taylor as key players. He had Pierce Lillis on Sean Powder. He had his own son, Podge, doing a job on Matty Taylor, and certainly, you know, curtailed the influence of those two fellas, and which left them in with a great chance of winning the game. So, kudos to Colm Collins once again on a brilliant performance yesterday.
Neil, where do Cork go from here? Even just on social media, there's a huge amount of soul searching going on. There's people looking for explanations about what's happening in underage, why they're not developing maybe the quality players that they need. When you think of the population, the amount of people playing football, the tradition there, the fact that wasn't that long ago they won an All-Ireland. What do you think they need to do to try and get to a stage where they were as competitive as they have been in the past?
Yeah, it's a strange one, Marie. And, you know, even talking to some people before yesterday's game, you know, while you had huge admiration for Clare and want them to get their goal in the round robin this year, you kind of, it's got to the stage where you view Cork as an underdog, which is strange, and you want them to come back to the top table. And because they have such a big pick, you want them to be competitive with Kerry and Munster and competing for All-Irelands, because there's so few teams that are capable of winning All-Irelands at the minute. They've had great underage success, probably better underage success than Kerry over the last 10-15 years, but it's very hard to see why it's not following through to senior. I know they've appointed full-time S&C coaches maybe in the last 12 to 18 months. You know, that was an area they felt that they were falling down on, you know, bringing those guys through from underage to senior, and maybe letting, because there is such a big pick, so many clubs, that guys can maybe disappear into that club scene a little bit, whereas, you know, in the likes of a Clare, a Limerick, you know, even a Sligo, every player is so precious that you have to kind of manage every player on the way through. You know, Cork maybe don't have that. Too many options can be a bad thing at times. But I think at the minute what they're really showing is a fragile confidence, and it's confidence in themselves, it's confidence in how they play. You know, Kevin Walsh has went in along with John Cleary this year, you know, probably tried to bring a little bit of organisation at the back. But then, you know, you see yesterday, at times they had bodies back, but they weren't maybe getting the contact on. And, you know, I think that for me reflects a team just lacking in belief. And even in the league, they showed that. Just that little bit of brittleness. Meade, the first day out, they conceded two or three goals. You know, probably got their league campaign back on track then. Great win up in Kildare. And then they go and lose to Louth, who, you know, you'd perceive Cork to be a stronger team than Louth. But then, you know, I suppose another element of their league campaign was beating Clare, which was, after Clare having the upper hand in the last few years, a huge win. So going into yesterday's game, you think, OK, is this Cork really about to reassert their dominance? And then when the game was in the melting pot in the second half, they just couldn't see it out.
Yeah, disappointing for all of them, for sure. Let's have a look at the big game of the weekend. Well, the perceived big game of the weekend, anyway, Peter, was Roscommon and Mayo. And we'll get to Roscommon in a second, but just on Mayo. And given all that they had achieved this season so far, there was a lot of expectation on them. I'm sure there was plenty of people that thought Roscommon were going to be able to do it. But look, given that Mayo had performed in the manner that they had this season, there was a lot of people expecting Mayo to do better than they did, only scoring 10 points. How big a setback is it for Kevin McStay, yesterday's result?
It's a setback, Marie, but it's not a massive setback. If anything, it could be argued that it gives them a better chance of winning the All-Ireland. If they had have went through Connacht and the round robin and so on, they could have ended up playing 9 or 10 games. This route, they'll have to play less games. So it will give them time to regroup. It will give them time, space to prepare for the round robin without the same level maybe of expectation or the hype that, you know, normally surrounds Mayo anyway. But the fact that they won the National League, it was further adding to that pressure. So with a stroke of a pen, that is gone. I don't think that they will be in the limelight in the same manner, and that might play into their hands. So it's not a massive setback with the format and the new championship structure, but certainly he'll be left scratching his head. The only thing, you know, a lot of us predicted them to win, but being there myself, having won National League titles and going out to play championship shortly after that, you are maybe on a false high. You don't do the same research and in-depth preparation. You don't have the time maybe that Roscommon had to do their homework on Mayo. So Mayo's focus had shift pretty quickly from winning the All-Ireland to getting ready for a really competitive Roscommon team. And for too many of them, they looked tired. They looked as sluggish as they have been this year. And that hasn't been certainly like Mayo. So it's a blip, but they have time to recover.
And Peter, just tactically then, was it a case that Davy Burke got his matchups right and he was able to execute the plan that he had?
Yeah, you can say that now with hindsight. Kevin McStay actually said after the game, look, if Mayo had took their goal chances at the start, they had two goal chances, they had three or four easy opportunities for points when they had the strong breeze and didn't take them. So it would have been a completely different game. But in terms of doing their homework, when the two sides met in the league, the kickouts was a serious problem for Roscommon. Mm-hmm. Any long kickouts that they had, they were wiped, they were cleaned out. They didn't have enough possession. And Mayo won the game easily enough. And the other learning from that game was Conor Cox got a goal towards the end of the game, a backdoor cut. They got in behind the Mayo defence. And they got a goal. Well, they got two identical goals doing the exact same thing yesterday. So whether they have worked, it appears they have worked for it. It wasn't by chance how they created that pocket of space round the D. And in terms of their kick-out strategy, they were dominant. They won so much of their own kick-outs against the breeze even. It was amazing. So you've got to give the kudos to the management for that regard. And the other big factor that I spoke about yesterday was hunger. In a competitive game, the hungrier side gives themselves a great chance of winning it. And you look at turnovers to determine which side was a hungrier one. And again, it was Roscommon that was turning Mayo over. And in fact, of their 10 scores, 6 of them came from turnovers. So it was an indication of a team that had their homework done, tactically very sound, but they were well wrapped up for it and they were well fired up for this game.
Neil, so often teams are a reflection of their manager, and just watching and listening to Davy Burke and the enthusiasm and the honesty and openness is brilliant. He leaves it all out there even when he's doing interviews, and then you look at his team and they just left it all out there from 1 to 15. They gave it everything. He had said beforehand that he wanted more structure around his defence. His defence couldn't have done any more for him yesterday, and actually the pictures going around about of the lads as well have been brilliant, but they've just been a joy really to see playing under him.
Yeah, Marie, I had the words on the tip of my tongue. The Roscommon performance yesterday, it nearly personified Davy Burke himself. You could see so much of Davy Burke in just their appetite for work, their enthusiasm, just the sheer enjoyment they were getting from every single second of the game. It was like every time one of them had a play, there was nearly a fist pump coming. Now they were able to control it and rein it in, but they were just bursting out of their skin to do whatever they could to get Roscommon over the line yesterday. And Peter touched on it there with their some of their defensive play was just top quality. Now you could argue as well that the conditions suited that. And also, I think another factor in that is that they got that lead early on. They got the penalty, they got the goal. It gave them something to hang on to. It gave them a little bit of belief. The Mayo crowd probably sucked the life out of their team a little bit, maybe got on top of them a little bit too quickly. But yeah, I think when we say that, Davy Burke was his team embodied his spirit and his personality and enthusiasm, I think that was also added to by maybe his backroom team as well, Mark McHugh and Jerry McGowan. They're, maybe two less heralded members, but two guys who would know how to set a team up defensively as well. And, that really shone through yesterday, that solidity. And, Mayo in the last 5 minutes looked just a little bit desperate, or, they kind of run out of ideas. And then there was, I think, around 66 minutes on the clock. Roscommon probably repelled Mayo going for goal probably too early, but repelled them maybe 5 or 6 times, made them go over and back to pitch, turned over the ball, and Jeremy Murta went down and kicked the score. And it was just everything that was great about Roscommon yesterday was in that 3 or 4 minutes of play.
Yeah, and I found as well, Neil, their decision making was really good. When the opportunity was on to take the scores, they did it at the right time.
Yeah, definitely. And that decision making was something that Davie Burke referenced afterwards in his interview. He said he looks for good decision makers, but you know, that's a nod as well to the experience that's in the Roscommon team. And you know, there's a few guys there. You know, Ennis Smith, he might only be 28, but he's on the scene since he was a very young lad. And you know, there's a few steely characters in there. You know, the Daly's, Niall Daly. You know, he's given Roscommon tremendous service, but just a steady head. You know, he's not going to get on the ball and try something silly. And in conditions like yesterday, that's even more important than it is, you know, during summer football, you know, when the game is a little bit faster. You know, they held the ball yesterday. And, you know, I seen Eamon Fitzmaurice on Saturday in his preview of the championship had mentioned Kerry adopting some tactics of South American football teams in terms of game management. Well, Roscommon managed the game excellently yesterday, especially in the first half. You know, there was 1 minute added time. If I was a Mayo player, I'd be a little upset with that. But at the same time, if I was a Mayo player and they had done the exact same thing, I'd be delighted with it. So I'd give Roscommon a lot of credit there. You know, I think a lot of Roscommon guys were mentioned yesterday, but one of the players out around the middle of the field who I thought did a monumental job for them was Keith Doyle. And especially in the absence of Tiger Roark, who picked up an injury during the week, you know, I thought he was excellent. And, you know, probably they had to get some of those guys around the middle of the field to put in longer shifts than they normally would if they had more options available. But, you know, really, really powerful stuff from Keith Doyle yesterday, I thought.
Peter, there was another game on in the Ulster Championship. It was a game in the Ulster Championship on Saturday, Antrim and Armagh, and I have to say, it was on the same time as Man City, and a couple of times I found myself switching over. It didn't really set the world on alight, but would Kieran McGeaney be happy after it, do you reckon?
You had a choice of Armagh and Man City, and you were watching Man City. I find that hard to believe. Kieran McGeaney will be happy. They're in the next round, and they did it without two or three of their better players. So he was given a few other men an opportunity to impress, and I think he would have been very content leaving the Athletic grounds. If there was a few things he wouldn't have been that happy when he reviews the game again, it was a fact maybe that Antrim had as many scoring opportunities as they did have. They did 30 attempts on goal, and the way Armagh, you know, had been playing this year, you'd have thought that's never going to happen. And they only scored, you know, a 9 of those 30 attempts. And I know Andy McEntee was bemoaning that fact, but it was after being relegated and things not being, you know, they were getting a fair bit of flack on social media and whatnot after things allegedly that had happened in the camp and whatnot. So it was important for Kieran to unearth a few men or give men valuable championship time and to win the game, and they did it, and you know, with something to spare. So I think he'll be looking forward to the Cavan game now in 2 weeks with a fair bit of optimism.
Okay, Peter and Neil, thank you so much for that. There were wins as well in the Leinster Championship yesterday for Offaly, for Laois and for Wicklow. We will be talking to you next week. We're going to take a very quick break now, though, but stay with us. We'll be talking to Jane Mangan about the Grand National, and Alan Cawley is mad to talk about the League of Ireland, so we'll be doing that too.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. It is time to turn our attention to racing. Grand National is not long over. Let's hear how it finished.
Four in line to the second last. Deffy Blue still has it, but just pulled up was Tenzingen. Now where when? Deffy Blue has Dulcita to contend with. Gevry on the near side. Panda Boy is next, and I Am Maximus trying to switch for another challenge. Gevry's going to lead to the last of the National, but just Dulcita's on the near side. Deffy Blue is tired, and Gevry now with Dulcita, and I Am Maximus from absolutely nowhere is coming through in the centre of the track. Gevry and I Am Maximus to the line. Paul Townend completes the CV. It's I Am Maximus has won the National from Gevry in second. In third.
Paul, well done. You've won many big races, but this is one you're after.
Yeah, this is a very special race, and it was looking unlikely, to be honest, for a long way. When Rich's horse fell up here, do you know what actually opened his eyes from? And just tried getting back popping. He was, you know, he was too slow jumping down the inside. I wanted to keep horses outside me, but it put me out of the race, and I just had to try and let them go left in, and banked on one at the last, and I got it.
Now, Paul Townend speaking there. After I Am Maximus was victorious in the Boyle Sports Grand Nationals for him and the all-conquering Willie Mullins, Jane Mangan joins us on the line now. Jane, a pretty special race.
It is, look, it's one of those illustrious races that has this tradition and legacy that you want to have your name on that trophy. You want to have that, you know, when people meet you in years to come and they say, well, what big races did you win? You want to be able to say the Irish Grand National was one of them. And look, we know that Willie Mullins is all conquering in Paul Town and having produces magic ride in the Gold Cup on Gallop in Deschamps. Well, I think only he could trump that. And today on I Am Maximus, given how lackluster he was early on, the position he found himself, basically last of 27 runners after a couple of fences, it would take a Houdini to pull off what he did. And, you know, sure enough, he managed it.
So, Jane, I was listening to Ruby afterwards and he said that it was one of the greatest rides of Paul Townend's career. And to people that don't know what they're looking at when they're watching racing, which I am one of, I thought he did well. I didn't realise it was that good. What exactly did he do to elevate that ride to where Ruby put it?
Essentially, he jumped off in a position where his plan was to be in the first half. He found himself after four fences, last or nearly last of the 27 runners. He was on the inside and his horse was not happy there. You could see he was jumping slowly. He was lethargic and maybe even claustrophobic. So he decided mid-race to make a maneuver from the inside to the outside to give his horse an opportunity to see his fences. There was no horses in front of him. They were all inside him, but he is forfeiting ground then by moving that far out. He ultimately asked his horse at every fence to keep in touch, and the horse then eventually starts to answer those calls. But because the Irish Grand National is an extreme distance of 3 miles, 5 furlongs, it's one of the longest races in the country, it gave him the time to do that. The horses in front started to capitulate. Fair play to Deffy Blow, who actually was on the pace with Fire Attack. He eventually finished third because everything else that raced prominently didn't finish or did not finish in the reckoning. So it is interesting that Ruby says it's one of his best rides, and we are caught up with the brilliant ride that it was. But I must give credit to the horse, because over three miles, 5 furlongs on testing ground in that race, he kept answering all of the questions.
It sounds like it was an impressive one. Alan Cawley's here nodding knowingly at me going, yeah, Marie, it was.
Well, looking at that, Jane, as well, you're obviously giving praise to the horse. Would that be kind of a rare thing like that, where the horse, as you even mentioned, I've never heard the phrase claustrophobic in a race. Would that be something that's very rare? And as you say, it was probably only the distance that the race was over that allowed Paul to get, I suppose, in one with the horse.
It's not rare, but usually going into a race of this magnitude, you have learned this before the race in previous runs. But I Am Maximus is a little bit of a weirdo. Okay, we're all weirdos in our own way. We all have our own characteristics, and we like things done a certain way. But he has been keen. He's jumped to his left, hence Paul Townend on a right-handed track, so all the fences are turning right-handed. He wants to go down the inside because his horse has a tendency to jump to his left. So if he has horses on his outside, he's not going to jump left because there's no room. So that would have been why he was down the rail in the first place, not only just to save ground. But ultimately, he's learned about the horse as they went around. There's a special mention for a number of the other horses. I've mentioned Deffy Blood to finish third. Angel Stone managed last of six finishers in the 27-runner race. I thought Brian Hayes was going to pull off a big one on Gevrey after only picking up the ride this morning. Kevin Sexton, who was due to ride him, fractured a vertebrae yesterday riding a horse for Gordon Elliott. Thoughts are with him. He would have thought he was missing out on a massive ride, and he managed to finish second. And the others didn't really get involved. So there was a number of disappointments from horses like the UK Raider Royal Pagai coming over. He fell midway through the race. Bustleton never got involved. Dalcita ran a good race, but I do think for Paul Townend, he is our champion jockey. You do expect brilliance from your champion jockey, but it's sometimes you just have to think, wow.
Well, that's fair enough, Jane. What about Fairy House the last few days? How's it been?
Oh, well, today was very good, but it was so wet and windy. We were a little bit soft, I suppose. We're getting to the sunshine in the long evenings now. But it was cold. Paul Townend had the rub of the green today. He had easy game win, the 420, but Janadil fell at the last when he looked like he was most likely winner. We saw the return of Monkfish first run in 2 years. Monkfish was the big hope for a Gold Cup at one stage of his career. He was off with injury for 2 years. He ran a really good race in defeat in the 350 behind his stablemate Asterion Ferlange. Great to see him back, and hopefully he'll be back over fences at the Punchestown Festival. And yesterday, well, Flame Bearer for Willie Mullins gave him the first six home in a Grade One novice chase. It's absolutely incredible. And while we might say, is that good or bad for the sport, his dominance, he's just better than everybody else at the moment. I will give a special mention for Andrew McNamara, who's off a regular contributor to our coverage on RT Racing. He had a Grade Two winner today. Dara O'Keefe rode it. She's quite an exciting mare, and he went to the UK. He spent a lot of money on her. She had decent form in Germany, and it goes to show that if you want to compete in Ireland, you're going to have to invest, and you're going to have to invest wisely, and he did that today.
Just, you know, we often talk on this show about the dominance of certain teams, whether it's Limerick or Man City or Leinster, and we're putting Willie Mullins into that now, Jane, and he is better than everybody else, but what is the, what impact then is that having on the rest of the sport? Like, what's the knock-on effects?
Well, there's a reason we go to Cheltenham and to Royal Ascot and to the meetings abroad and are the best. And that's because our bar is so high. And Willie Mullins has taken the bar from 10 or 15 years ago and he's raised it. And everybody now needs to come to his level or you will starve. There will be no food left on the table for you unless you rise to his level. And that's what he's done. Number one, he's obviously a magic trainer. Number two, he's assembled a fantastic team. But three, he has got the investment and has used it wisely. You know, anybody, I could give, you know, you could give a soccer manager a lot of money and tell me, buy me the best players. Like Roman Abramovich did with Chelsea for a time. And nice, they had Jane. Great success. But, you know, over time, you either sustain that by continued reinvestment wisely or you don't. And the horses he's buying seem to be the real deal. And then when you get the results, the owners want to be with you, which makes it cyclical because you get reinvestment.
And I know you can't see into the future, but are other people going to catch up? Is he going to continue to be all conquering, Willie, do you reckon?
Well, he will be for the foreseeable future, but there's people who are definitely able to compete with him. Look, Gordon Elliott's a self-made man in a relatively short space of time. He had desperate misfortune yesterday, losing his very good horse, Mighty Potter. But, you know, he's won a Gold Cup with Don Cossack, and hopefully he'll get another Mighty Potter, and hopefully he'll keep, you know, building on what he's created. Gavin Cromwell has done it in recent years. John McConnell, the Cheltenham Festival winner this year, so did Tony Martin. So, yes, there are fantastic talent in this country, but there just needs to be a more, I suppose, spread of the investment. And when I see JP McManus have success, he did success today, obviously, for Willie Mullins, but he has a spread of a trainer base that is just, I'm in awe of that man, because he gives everybody a chance, and he knows that everybody, that there's a lot of equine talent in this country, but there's also a lot of horsemanship in this country that can be utilised outside of Clissutton. So, as I said, Ireland are punching above their weight when it comes to the equine world, but that is because the bar is so high, and Willie Mullins is currently setting that bar.
Thank you so much, Jane Mangan. As insightful as always.
Oh, well, always a pleasure. Happy Easter, everybody.
And you. Talk to you soon, Jane.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, we're going to take a very quick break. Stay with us, though. We have League of Ireland and Premier League to come.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Dan Cawley is still with me in studio, waiting patiently to talk about his beloved League of Ireland.
Yes, Marie, yeah. I'm heading to a match tonight. You know, when you see the big grin on my face that I'm going to a match. And we had a good weekend as well. As I said, we watched Shamrock Rovers and all the talk at the start of the season. And it's been a really good start to the season as well, in terms of teams getting off to good starts. And strangely enough, Shamrock Rovers haven't got off to that good start. But looking at them Friday night, and obviously coming off the back of the win up in Dundalk as well the week before that, they were so impressive. Which Shamrock Rovers fans might be sitting at home wondering, is that Alan Cawley giving us praise? Because they're always on my case, Marie, and I don't know why. But they were very, very good. Yeah, very good. And Bohemians, of course, went into the game with so much hype and excitement because they were the ones that got off to the great start and were sitting at the top of the pile. But it was almost a statement from Shamrock Rovers to show everybody, we haven't gone away, boys.
What was it, Al, do you think that has caused them to be so slow out of the blocks?
Yeah, it's a funny one, really, Marie, especially when you think of the talent that they have at their disposal. But I didn't see all the games, but I'd seen three or four of them in the start that they made, and listening to Stephen Bradley as well, he always felt the performances were good. They had a couple of disciplinary issues as well at the start where they had players sent off in a couple of games that you'd expect them to win, and obviously you give the other team a chance if you're down to 10 men, and it was 9 at one stage in Drogheda as well, which gave Drogheda a great chance, and they picked up the draw that night. So a couple of little issues like that, but Stephen always maintained that the performances were very good, plus the fact it was still so early and they had been there, done it over the last 3 years. They weren't getting excited, they weren't pressing any kind of crazy buttons in terms of panicking, Marie, and they just did exactly what they've been doing for such a number of years now. And it, as I say, it just looked like they were getting into their groove on Friday night, and it was almost the case of sometimes as well, like you were speaking there about teams being dominant, and Willie, obviously Leinster, all those teams, Limerick, and sometimes when questions are put to you, that's when you show that they're a real sign. It's easy when all things are going well, Marie, but that's when you see when the real champions are there, when there's a few questions put to you. And that was the case this year with Shamrock Rovers. Over the last 2 or 3 weeks, the questions were asked, but they've certainly answered.
Yeah, they have. Just to maybe have a quick recap of some of the results on Friday night. And look, a big one for Drogheda was beating Derry City. And Derry City are the team that you'd be expecting to be right up there. But look, well, I guess, look, Drogheda did actually catch Shamrock Rovers a couple of times last season as well. They're tough to beat.
Well, it was an unbelievable result, really. And not all that surprising, really, Marie, when you think that the start that they've got off to Drogheda, and like, everybody knows I'm good friends with Kevin, the manager, so I know what's going on there to a certain extent. And he's talking about punching above your weight. It's phenomenal, really, when you think of the resources he's working off compares to the likes of a Shamrock Rovers or compares to all the other full-time teams. So bar UCD, everybody else is full-time, and Kevin would have been working that day, obviously doing the post, then get on the bus, go up to Derry. He would have had a lot of players who might have been working half days as well, Marie. So when you think of that and you put it into that kind of context, it's phenomenal, really, that they can go to the Brandywell and pull off the victory. They're sitting on 12 points now, fourth in the table, and it's incredible, really.
So this evening we already have Cork City and Dundalk underway. 85 minutes gone there, and Cork City are leading 1-0, which would be a really big result for them if they can see that one out. The big game is Derry City and Bowes. You're heading along to that one, Alan. Have you some team news?
Yeah, team news here. This is kicking off at 7 in the Brandywell, Marie. So Derry City obviously coming off the back of that defeat, they'll be bitterly disappointed with. But Adam O'Reilly comes back into the team. He was one of the signings in the off season, who was probably one of the best young players in the league last year with St. Pat's. They managed to capture him in the off season, but he's missed a lot of the games in the early part with injury, but he's back in the team tonight, so that's a huge plus for them. McGonagall as well comes into the team, and they're playing against Bowes, who've made a lot of changes from the game the other Friday, to defeat the Shamrock Rovers, probably just to freshen things up and to give a couple of lads a chance as well. James Clark hasn't featured all that much. I'm a big fan of him, a young player in the midfield. Made a change at the back as well, with Jay Benn coming in at right full, and Grant Horton switches to centre half. So they'll be looking to bounce back as well. Of course, Declan Devine from Derry going up to the Brandywell to play against Derry City. So that's a story in itself. And they will, as I say, be looking to bounce back from that defeat, because they've got off to a great start, Bohemians. I never had them down really as title challengers anyway, Marie. I think in Declan's first season, if he was to get them into Europe, I think that would be a great return for them. And they're well on course. Obviously, it's still only early, but they're well on course with the start that they've had. So he will be looking for a response. But of course, Derry themselves have to bounce back from that shock defeat to Drogheda, and I think Derry will get the job done.
Okay, the other games this evening then, Drogheda, St. Pat's, Shelburne, Sligo Rovers, that's the one you're going to, Al.
Yeah.
And Shamrock Rovers and UCD, that one is at 8 o'clock. Okay, let's move on from the League of Ireland, because we did have one of those, it feels like a bit of a crazy weekend in the the Premier League. And look, I guess all we can do is start with that Arsenal and Liverpool game yesterday and try and make sense of it, because it was absolutely turned on its head in a moment of madness, I think, anyway, with Granit Xhaka, Alan. And it was funny listening to Gary Neville and to a lot of the analysis post-match about not poking the bear with the Liverpool crowd. And Granit Xhaka, as always, he cannot help himself, Alan.
Yeah, 100% Marie, and you're so right to start, I suppose, the analysis and the review of that game with that moment, because exactly as you said, it was turned on its head. I was sitting watching the match. Arsenal were so good the first half an hour, went 2-0 up, Liverpool all over the place, defending shambolically as they've done over the last number of weeks. All the questions being asked of where they're at, and Klopp under pressure, looking like that they were going to suffer another heavy defeat. And then Xhaka, as you said, gets himself involved with Trent, who was having a nightmare himself. Trent Alexander,
another one.
Yeah, he was having a nightmare, and why he did it, Xhaka, only he will know. But as you say, he just can't seem to help himself. And to be fair to him, this year he's been very, very good. He hasn't really got involved in any of the skirmishes that we're used to.
He did one, and there's a. I can't remember who they were playing, but all I remember is Arteta just seeing that he was about to get involved and sprinting down the pitch and taking him out of it. And after that was early in the season.
Spurs, was it maybe?
Yeah, it was the big row.
Yeah.
And after that, he must have had a chat with him, because he totally calmed down and he was staying out of everything. And there was no Xhaka stories, no cards, nothing. He was just fitting into the system, doing what he had to do, leading by example, and then just one moment.
Yeah, and I think he cost him as well, Marie, and he's cost him a number of times in terms of getting sent off. And it might be a strange thing to say, the fact that he wasn't sent off, he was still on the pitch, but that moment changed the game completely and changed the momentum of the game and where it was heading. And it's almost like, if you're looking to, I suppose, get the best out of Trent, Klopp just needs to give him a kick or give him an elbow or something before the match, because he sprang into life as well. And obviously he got very riled, as you say, the crowd got involved in the game, who were very quiet for that first 40 minutes, and it frustrates Liverpool, because you look at what's capable with that team and that squad, because you look at the second half performance, Marie, they were absolutely brilliant. And Arsenal will be delighted just to get out with a point, because all the momentum was with Liverpool. They missed the penalty, Nunes had an unbelievable chance, should have scored, a couple of little close calls near the end as well, and for whatever reason, and Arteta will be furious, because, as I said, a difficult place to go, Arsenal haven't won there in such a long time. They were heading towards that victory, and for him to produce that moment of madness may just cost them when it comes to the end of the season, because if they're to lose out by a point or two, they will look back at that moment and think, that's where we messed up massively.
Stephen Kelly is with us on the line as well. Stephen, did you play the same position as Trent Alexander-Arnold?
Yes, I did.
So when you're looking at him now, and how do you even describe him? Like, he looks like he's a defender who can't defend. Like,
doesn't want either.
How do you assess him as somebody who played in the same position as him?
I think he genuinely has no interest in it. When you watch him, honestly, that's it. Just from his body language and his movement, you know, the odd time there's a bit of urgency to get back in there, but there's no natural instinct to want to cover your centre backs or get in and involved. Robertson does it a lot more. But you see Trent, like, a player runs past him or he's out of position, and there's no desire to, like, most fullbacks will just sprint back in the middle of the pitch if the centre back comes out to cover his position, whereas Trent just seems to be nonchalantly striding back in there. But then you go to the other end and look what he can produce, and you're just going, like, he's a sensational footballer. Like, his technical ability is off the charts. Like, when he goes through, there's not many fullbacks that not make someone go through, take a touch, get the head up, and then pick out the perfect cross in such a congested area to crowd up an equaling goal. So, you know, for all his flaws defensively, I still think you're playing. But I think it's just Liverpool, if they can get that balance in midfield and winning the ball back high up the pitch, that's when he's at his utmost best. But when he actually has to defend, and the likes of Konate and Van Dijk are not at their best, then he's exposed way more than what he normally is.
This Marie is really annoying me, because obviously Liverpool have had their problems. He's one of the major problems that they have. Klopp's such a brilliant manager. Surely he can see what we all can see. Of course he can. But why they're persistent with playing him there? Because, as Stephen said, there was a couple of moments in the game. The first minute, Martinelli ran at him, and he waltzed by him after only 30 seconds, Marie, and the writing's on the wall. Then he picked up a ball from, I think it was a corner over on the left-hand side. He happened to be over on that side of the pitch. Played a 50-yard pass with his left foot to Salah, which was incredible. His weaker foot. And we're kind of saying, all right, defending, he's a disaster, but look what he's capable of on the ball. Then, as Stephen said, he sets up the goal with a brilliant piece of play. But I think the question has to be asked now. You maybe move him into midfield.
Well, that's what I would say. 100%.
And it's an area where Liverpool are obviously people are questioning that they're weak and that they don't have the legs and the energy. He's a fit boy. He can get around the place. He's dynamic. Play him as one of those number eights maybe, because as you say, you have to get him into the team. But every time I see him right full, I'm saying to myself, like, this is a disaster waiting to happen. And it's almost at the stage where the lad now, even you look at him, you're like, you're saying there about the question, can he defend? He doesn't want to defend. He has no interest in it.
Fergal Brennan is with us on the line as well. Fergal, there's so many talking points from yesterday's game, and look, one of the glaring ones is the incident with Andy Robertson and the linesman. Just in terms of fallout from that, you're on Merseyside obviously. What's the latest?
So the linesman that was involved, or the assistant referee, I'm going to give his name a go. I've been practicing this before I came on. Konstantin Hazezakakis has been stood down for probably the next 2 weekends of Premier League action. This was I was at the game yesterday, and I have to be honest, it was so far away from where we were sitting in the press area that I didn't completely see it. Andy Robertson just looked like a blur in the distance as he was going over to have a bit of a row with the linesman. And when you watch the replays back, it was very, very bizarre. I think maybe it's been overblown a little bit, but it's very clear that he at least raises his arm to kind of move Robertson out of his way, which when you consider the stakes that are involved, it's a Premier League game, Premier League footballer, you're a Premier League match official, it's absolutely crazy. And there's been obviously this back and forward in terms of discussion, some of the punditry with Roy Keane and Jamie Carragher after the game, and then there's been reports from the PGMOL today basically saying we realise these situations happen, but you just cannot react, and that effectively is what's gone on. You cannot react in this sort of situation. I don't think he's attacked Robertson, or I don't necessarily think he's hit him, but he's certainly moved towards him in an aggressive way, and that's something that will be investigated in the next couple of weeks.
And so it should, for sure. But Stephen, like, there's incidents with referees and fourth officials and things happening off the field and on the field, but it all comes to comes back to the same thing, that the relationship between officials and footballers and fans and the football community, it's very fraught, and there seems to be a tolerance towards, it doesn't matter who, having a go at referees, whether it's in post-match interviews, whether it's on the pitch, whether it's parents, and it doesn't seem to be getting any better. You've been in a situation where you've played at that level. Have you ever seen anything like that before, Stephen?
Not with the ref reacting like that. And I have to admit, I'm more on the ref side of things for this one. I genuinely am. I watch it. I think Robertson puts his hand on the ref first, and I think he's just shoving his arm away, and it goes harder than what's expected. I don't think there's any intent to strike Robertson whatsoever. But I just think the referees have to have a no-tolerance policy. If a player comes over to ref and gets his face, they should just book him straight away. I was a player, and I would have been wound up to the knot, absolutely off my, and gone and screened the referees, but that's because I could have got away with it, and I knew I could get away with it. If I knew I couldn't, I wouldn't do it. As soon as I approached the referee and said, shouting, I'm a screamer, I'm more effing, I'm blind, and I'll put my hand on him, if I knew I did any of that and I was going to get a red card straight away, I wouldn't do it. You're too sensible. You know, you get caught up in the moment, but your head takes over. You think, I can't go near him, I'm not going to interject. There should be just no tolerance policy from referees for any of that. Like, afterwards, Liverpool, like, Henderson puts his hand on the referee later on. Like, that, you mean, it's there's so much has happened throughout that game that is wrong. Yes, his arm raises up and it looks like it's almost going to strike his chin. But if you're looking at it closely enough, Robertson puts his arm on the ref to stop him walking in the direction he's going on. He almost goes to shove him away. And then it's kind of like those talks of assault on TV, to him laughing, going, are you absolutely kidding me? Like, that's ridiculous. Like, nonsense, absolute nonsense for that. But this is filtering down to every level of football. I coach my under boys 10 under team, right, at football. And the abuse the refs get.
Oh, we've lost Stephen on that.
He's right what he's saying though, Maria. Yeah. He's 100% right what he's saying. And that incident, you can't put your hand on the referee. Mm-hmm. That's a no-go area. And no matter how annoyed you are, how frustrated you are, you can't put your hand. We all criticise referees for their decisions, but there has to be some point or some line where you can't cross. And putting your hand on the referee, that's the line. You just can't do that. I think, to be fair to the linesman yesterday as well, he kind of just brushes up his arm. Like, it wasn't a case of him trying to elbow Andy Robertson. Yeah. It's been blown out of all proportion.
I think think, to be fair to Roy Keane, he actually probably diffused the whole thing by calling Andy Robertson a baby, and he just made the whole scene seem almost pathetic, like the whole thing.
And it was, and like crying and whinging about it, like, yeah, you know, as if he did do something on purpose to him. I don't think that was the case at all. But you're right about the whole, like, we see it in our own league here, Marie, that the relationship between referees and players and everybody else is at an all-time low, yeah, and something needs to be done about it. There was another incident in Dundalk Friday night, grassroots match or a men's junior football match or whatever, referees attacked after the match. You can't have that.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I think that Stephen's right. Even if it's a case where people, they need to start getting the cards out and just getting them out all the time, and that's the only way from the bottom up, and that's the only way they're going to start learning. Let's very quickly go through some of the other results. Fergal, Man City, Southampton, 4-1 win, and for Arsenal then to go out and look, I guess you can't really look at it, well, I mean, maybe you will, you'll know more at the end of the season whether it was they dropped points or they came away with the point, but the timing of Manchester City been so impressive. It's always going to be, it's going to be a difficult run in really for Arsenal with Man City being so good.
It is. I mean, it depends on which way you look at it. I think if you analyse the game yesterday, given Arsenal's terrible record at Liverpool in the Premier League, they've not won there since Arteta was a player all the way back in 2012. I think, despite the fact that Arsenal have been far better than Liverpool this season and they're pushing for the title and Liverpool are kind of scrabbling for a potential Europa League place, but it's not a disastrous result for Arsenal yesterday in terms of what they would have anticipated to get. The way the game kind of fell apart and the Xhaka incident that you mentioned, obviously, yes, when you look at it through that kind of perspective, you would have that mentality. But I just still think it all comes down to the game against City in a couple of weeks' time, because as it stands now, City, you would anticipate they win their game in hand, and then if City beat Arsenal, then they go above them on goal difference. And I just think it's all going to be on that, because the anticipation that the two teams will go punch for punch all the way until the end of the season is probably going to be the case. If Arsenal can come through that game with a point or even a win, then I think they're okay. But it just all comes down to that. And it's a fascinating way to look at it, because, you know, we all like that bit of drama. But I really do think that is a bona fide title decider.
Stephen, did anybody think that Frank Lampard was going to have a glorious return to Chelsea?
No, I don't think so. But what a goal, though, from the Wolves and Nunes. What a strike. But Chelsea just, you know, Lampard gone back in there. I don't understand what the thought process is. Maybe he's good with youth. Maybe they felt that was an option for them. But from everything I've watched before, like, him going to get a job, there was no chance he was getting a Premier League job. His stock was so low. So to be given this opportunity, I think it was so out of the blue that no one was expecting to go that well. But the thing is, with the squad they have, if they do in any way knit it together, they could be a very good side.
Alan, Man United 2-0 win over Everton.
Everton were absolutely horrendous, Marie. Honestly, it was so bad. I watched Everton against Spurs on Monday night and I thought they'll definitely get out of relegation. Sean Dyche, very good manager, has them well organised, well disciplined, fought till the end, even when they went down to 10 men, showed a great reaction and deserved their point. And I was thinking this would be a tough game for United. It was probably the easiest game they'll play all season. They were so bad, Everton, and like all the things you'd associate with a Sean Dyche team in terms of how well organised they are defensively, they were the complete opposite. It wasn't even any good balls or passes over the top, and they were getting in one on one. Only for Pickford, who gets a lot of stick, it would have been about 8-0. Marie, it was an easy win for United. A disgraceful performance from Everton.
So I sometimes feel sorry for the Everton fans. It just feels like it's never going to get better for them. Well, that's all we have time for this evening. Alan, Fergal and Stephen, thank you so much for joining us. Beto da Silva is up next, and I'll be back tomorrow here on Game On.